Welcome to the Nikonians Image Doctors. This is episode number 49 for September 13th, 2007. I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And we join you once again for our bi-weekly excursion into the world of Nikonians and photography.
Yep.
What do we got on tap for today, Rick?
Well, several topics. We've got a Nikonians ANPAT trip coming up. That's the annual Nikonians photo adventure trip. I think I got all the words correct on that. And so we're just going to talk a little bit about preparation for it and specifically discuss storage strategies while you're out there in the field. This is a topic we've been intending to do for probably about a year, I think. And for whatever reason, we always just have something else that we want to discuss. So we'll talk about that, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about the D3 and D300 and just fall out from that, subsequent thoughts, and hopefully some rational ideas to go along with that too.
Right.
Yeah.
We've got a product review today. We'll be reviewing the NRD Firefly, which is a sensor cleaning system, and I've had a chance to check that out. And then, as always, we'll have our weekly photo prescription.
Right. And so, this one is on creative cropping.
Yeah, it's a good topic, I think. So before we go into the ANPAT, let's just talk a little bit about some of the fallout. We've gotten seen a lot of threads, a lot of comments regarding our take on the D3 and the D300. And probably the biggest one, well, there's two things that people are kind of, I would say, freaking out about, but it's probably much ado about nothing. And one is, how come the D3 is only 12 megapixels and not more? And I think we addressed that a little bit. Both of us are fairly convinced that Nikon will be entering a high megapixel camera into the fray, just not until early, or you know, sometime in 2008. Neither of us have any inside information on when that announcement will be, but we're pretty sure we're going to see something in the 20 megapixel range, as you know. So what is that, you know, is that a big deal, Rick, having 20 megapixels versus 12?
I think it depends on what kind of shooting you're doing and more specifically what you're doing in the way of prints. You know, it's something I thought a little bit about before plunking down my money on a D3 deposit. And the conclusion I came to is that, you know, I really don't make that many large prints. I've made a few, you know, made a few in your printer, in fact, as you've got such a big one, but just a couple. You know, most of the prints I make are in a 13 by 19 category, and for me, that's usually just fine, and I've only got so much wall space at home and, you know, things like that. So, you know, the 12 megapixel amount is more than enough. You know, it produces very high quality prints in that size or a bit above it. And so do I really need the extra expense and the extra megapixels, you know, hanging around? You know, it's hard for me to rationally come up with a reason to go for that. And in fact, you know, we were looking at a print that you made for a friend this morning. It was a soccer picture of one of his sons. And it was actually a D2X image that was cropped down to about, what, 5?
Yeah, it was just under 5 megapixels.
Yeah. And this was a 16 by 20 that was utterly gorgeous. I mean, there's no way looking at that print that you would think it was made with that few megapixels. But the reality is, for a lot of subjects, and sports are a perfect example, you don't really need all that many, even in bigger print sizes.
And the fact that this was a 5 megapixel image means that had I had the same crop on a D3 using the DX, that's about a 5 megapixel image, I could have produced a 16 by 20. I couldn't have cropped it any further than that. I couldn't have gotten this same image with a D3, and then I would have had to crop it more. But the point is, a 5 megapixel image produced an outstanding 16 by 20 print. And I've heard some, you know, I've talked to some people and read some things from folks who've tried the D3, and what I'm hearing is that the quality of the pixels are so good that the images hold up incredibly well when you enlarge them. So my feeling with this whole resolution deal is that we've got a 12 megapixel camera that gives you enough resolution for pretty much the, you know, 90% of what you need, unless your needs is large stock agencies that have particular requirements. But I think more importantly is that what are you gaining with the more megapixels, or what are you losing with fewer? I think Nikon's strategy was to say, to address a camera to produce high ISO images as cleanly as possible and deliver a fast frame rate. The D3 delivers that. The strategy they took was not the number of pixels, but the size of them, the quality of them.
Yeah, and even stepping back a moment, you know, when the digital bodies were first coming out, there were a lot of stock agencies and magazines and stuff that were saying, oh, no, you know, like a 6-megapixel camera just doesn't produce images that are of high enough quality to even put on a single page in a magazine.
Much less a double truck.
Yeah, yeah, much less a double truck. So, you know, that was what was going around at the time. And it was one of the things that, along with others, pushed the megapixel race, I think. But now, given some more time and more of those images being out there, you know, that people have shot over the last years, I don't know about you, but I regularly see absolutely gorgeous images from D100s and D70s and the like that are double truck in photography magazines, and they look fantastic.
Yeah.
So a lot of it was just a misunderstanding about
and I think
how
ignorance.
Digital, yeah.
I think ignorance on the part of some of these agencies. You know, some of it's they don't want to have submissions from any old people, so they try to restrict you by saying, "Oh, well, if you don't have this many megapixels, you can't play in our." Yeah. In our pool. The other thing I think was just their ignorance of dealing with digital files.
Right.
You know, they didn't have a workflow.
Everyone was learning, honestly, too.
Right. So,
but we're not promising that we won't be tempted by, you know, something next year, but, you know, trying to look at this rationally, it's, you know, realistically, it's enough for most of what I do. That's for sure.
The second question that's sort of going around is, oh my God, Nikon has a full frame camera. Does this mean that DX is dead?
Yeah, it isn't for me.
Let's just say no.
Yeah, both of us are getting D3s, and both of us are planning to continue shooting in the DX format at times, right?
Right. I mean, it has some advantages.
It really does.
And namely, not necessarily, you know, the people talk about the size and the weight, but not necessarily the size and the weight of the lens, although that's one thing, but to me, what's very attractive is being able to use something like a D300 and pack light, mm-hmm. where I could pack two D300s in the same amount of space, or, you know, not much more space than what I'd have for a single D2X body or a D3 body, mm-hmm. And then be able to get away with some smaller lenses for it. You know, in those times where you do need to pack light, we had our episode a month or two ago about packing light. Well, DX is a great way to go if you're trying to pack light.
Yeah.
Something like those. So I'm not planning on selling my 17-55 lens by any means. I'll use it on my D2X, or if I get a D300, mm-hmm. that's what I'll continue to use it in those circumstances.
I have no plans to sell any of my DX lenses either. It just same precise reason now. You know, we'll see what happens, but I just don't see it right now.
And look at it from a practical side, people. There are, as of today, September, there are still zero full-frame Nikons on the market. Every other Nikon camera that's out there is going to use a DX lens. So I don't think that DX lenses are going to lose their value. They may lose some perceived value, but there's a huge market out there of people who are going to be shooting DX. Let's face it. Not everyone has $5,000 to throw out a D3.
Yeah.
And if there is a new higher megapixel D3X or whatever it might be called,
but I don't think we're going to
afford that either.
Yeah, this isn't just a money issue, though. There are very practical, sound reasons
absolutely.
For shooting in a DX format, just some of the things that you mentioned. So it's not all about money by any means.
Because that 16-20 that I printed yesterday wouldn't have been nearly as good if I had shot it with the same lens on a FX format body.
Right.
Unless I had really high pixel density. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the last little thing to point out we may have overlooked on the D3 and the D300 is there's been some talk about the buffer not being that large. Mm-hmm. But then I've seen a lot of references now that these new cameras take advantage of the UDMA and the higher memory card mm-hmm. specs, so like the SanDisk Extreme 4s and the Lexar 300X. And when we talked about the Extreme 4 SanDisks, we said, well, there's not really much benefit in your camera, you'll see a benefit when you download the slides. I think the game is changing here. Mm-hmm. You're going to see the benefit now in your newer cameras that can take advantage of that standard. So having large buffers won't be quite as important because you'll be able to clear it.
Yeah,
really,
if you
fast.
Clear them out really fast with really high transfer speeds, the number of images you can have in a buffer isn't as important.
Yeah. So I think that's another little thing. Mm-hmm. Moving on now, we got the 7th ANPAT coming up, which is will be, let's see, this will be my 3rd ANPAT. I missed last year.
It'll be my 3rd, too.
Because you missed the year before
last. Yeah, right. Right.
And this one's going to be, I'm very excited, by the way.
Oh, I am
too. I can't wait. Spending a week with fellow Nikonians is one of the best things ever.
Especially when it's in a great location.
Yeah. And this location is one of the tops, been on my list for a long time. Mm-hmm. Namely Jackson Hole, the Tetons National Park, and Yellowstone National Park. Mm-hmm. And this time of year, we're getting into that fall colors again. And my fingers are crossed, but it's going to offer a little bit of everything.
Yeah, and I've shot at those locations pretty much the same exact week that we'll be going. We'll be starting on, I think, the 29th of September, right? And it's just fabulous there. The fall colors at Grand Teton in particular are just unbelievable. Just unbelievable. So it should be a great time. But as with every trip, you know, you start thinking about, all right, what are we going to take?
And how are you going to bring it?
Yeah.
Now, this trip, we're going to drive.
Right.
Because from Colorado, it's not terribly far.
No.
It's a long day in the car, but
yeah,
it's definitely
doable.
But
we can start at a reasonable hour in the morning, like 8 o'clock, and be there for dinner. Mm-hmm. So that's not bad at all.
So that's the plan. And then, which frees up a little bit in terms of, you know, how you're going to pack. Mm-hmm. But one thing I've been trying out, because this is such a diverse shooting environment. I mean, again, it's that whole... Nature photography is one of the most rewarding, but it's sort of the most frustrating from a gear standpoint because you need everything. Mm-hmm. And Yellowstone and the Tetons are no exception because we expect not only wonderful landscapes, but also a fair bit of wildlife, especially in Yellowstone. So that means bringing along the 200 to 400 and teleconverters. It means bringing along your good tripod that can hold it. I've been using the Think Tank glass taxi for my 200 to 400. And I have to say, it's pretty interesting. I've liked it so far. Mm-hmm. Because it allows me to wear a little backpack. It's a very small backpack, but big enough to hold the 200 to 400. Or I think even a 500 F4 will fit in it. Hmm. And then it attaches to the Think Tank belt system. It's got a Velcro flap underneath, so it just sort of clips on. So it allows you to have a couple of lenses in the pouches on the side, but also bring your big gun around mm-hmm. without having to have the huge bag, you know, for those times where, you know, so when you want access to your other lenses and you don't want to always have to put the backpack down, you can get the benefits of the belt, but still have something to carry your big gun in should you need that.
Right. And one nice thing about it too is if for some reason you're not using the bigger lens in an area, which is common, you could do two things. You could just remove the backpack from the belt, and like you're saying, it's just Velcro, so it's easy. Or you could take the lens out, keep it in the car, and throw a lightweight coat or other things in there in that space.
As with all of the Think Tank products, which, you know, as everyone who's listened to us for all know, we really like them.
Yeah.
The bag comes with dividers, mm-hmm. so you could use it as a small bag to put other stuff in if you really wanted to. Mm-hmm. You could put I've rigged it up with my 70 to 200 attached to a body. Mm-hmm. That can work as well.
Yep.
So it's just a lot of things. I think that's how I'm going to go. I may still bring, since we're going to be in the car, I may still, you know, do some other stuff around, you know, just to make things easier for packing. But, we'll be shooting DX on this trip.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And that means the usual
and
suspects.
It'll be a good choice for this trip too,
it will
by
be.
The way.
Yeah. Yeah. But the usual suspects, I'm sure we'll have the 17 to 55, the 70 to 200.
105 macro probably.
And I'll probably bring my Sigma 10-20. I'm sure you'll have your 12-24.
Mm-hmm.
So the stuff we've talked about on previous AMPADs we'll be bringing.
Yeah.
Grad filters, all of the above.
Polarizers.
Mm-hmm. All those good things. So they'll go in there. Now, if you're going on the AMPAD, before we talk about strategies for storage in the field, if you're going on the AMPAT, you probably have a few last-minute purchases that you're thinking about. Maybe you need to get a filter or an extra battery for your camera. Be aware that one of our favorite stores, B&H, they're going to have a lot of closing. They're going to be closed down and not accepting orders for a good part of September, just the normal Jewish holiday schedule that they do. So if you're looking to get something, keep that in mind and consider ordering from Nikonian's sponsor, Roberts Imaging. Mm-hmm. Or Burger Brothers, who've done very well by Nikonians in the past. So consider ordering from one of our sponsors, because they are open and they won't be subject to the same closing schedule that B&H is.
Yeah, and I know we've both had really good luck with Roberts.
And Burger Brothers, too. Mm-hmm. Both of those have been very well for it. So now let's just talk about what our strategy for storage is in the field. Once upon a time, memory cards were not only expensive, but they weren't particularly high capacity.
Right.
Which meant you needed a lot of cards, or you needed to be continually backing them up to some sort of external device.
Mm-hmm.
The landscape is changing a little bit in that, wouldn't you say?
I would say so.
When I bought my D2X in the spring of 2005, when they first came out, I shelled out for a 4 gig SanDisk Extreme 3 card, and I think it cost me $400.
Mm-hmm.
I purchased an 8 gig Extreme 4 card recently for $199.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we even got a couple 8 gig cards for less than that, not too long.
There was a sale. Sometimes you
have
a rebate or something like that.
And so cards have gotten so cheap and so large that in some cases you don't even need to have some sort of external device on a lot of trips. It just depends on how many images you're going to shoot and
for how long you're going.
Yeah, and the camera you're using too will have an influence on it.
Right. Now for the AMPAT, we're going to be out there for, I think, 6 or 7 days,
mm-hmm.
which, depending on what we're shooting, we could be filling up cards quite easily.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing I want to do is I want to get around an 8 gig card for my D2X. That, to me, that's an all day shoot if I'm shooting landscapes, possibly into the next day.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point you're going to want to back those images up. So there's a couple strategies, and what you do depends on how, if you're shooting for fun, it's one thing. If you're shooting for a client, for a paid job, it's a completely different story. I know a lot of pros whose philosophy is to not erase their memory cards until they are back.
Mm-hmm.
And what they will do is back up everything off their card every day, but still not erase the card.
Right.
So that means you're bringing not only enough memory cards to cover your entire shoot, but you're also bringing a portable storage device of some kind. Usually, and there's a couple options on that. There's the two choices are there's portable storage like hard drives that are designed to accept a memory card into it. You download into the, and they usually have a viewer,
right?
But not all of them do. And then there's the traditional laptop, and you just download to a laptop while you're in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you have both. I don't have a portable storage device,
right?
And but I have a laptop, and what I do with my laptop is I have an external hard drive that I attach to my laptop, which allows me to create a redundant backup copy of everything. So I've got, if I really wanted to, I could have all my images in three places.
Mm-hmm.
The card, the laptop hard drive, and an external hard drive that I can attach to the laptop.
Right. And on trips like the AMPAT, where, we're driving, it's not too big of an issue to haul around a laptop and stuff. That's what I'm going to do.
Right. And we're staying in a hotel where there's power and I can connect.
Like with you, I always carry around an external hard drive that hooks into my laptop. I think I've got one that's, like 100 gig or something like that. So it's plenty big for trips like this and more than that for sure. And the thing I like about it is what I'll usually do is download the images to both the external hard drive and to my laptop. There are a lot of tools anymore that will do simultaneous writes, which is really nice. And that allows me to take a look at my images on my laptop, as the trip progresses, and very often I'll change my ideas about, what I'm doing. And you know, maybe recognize that what I thought was working well for one kind of shot isn't, and I'll correct what I'm doing the following day. But it also makes it really easy at the end of the trip, because I just have all my images on that external hard drive, and when I get home, I just simply plug it into my desktop unit and download them to that.
Right. I do the same thing.
And then after I'm completely confident that I've got everything, nothing's gone awry with that process, then I'll delete the images off my laptop. But usually I don't hurry.
Right. And what I tend to do now with the larger capacity cards is I will use fresh cards until I run out. Mm-hmm. And then I'll make a decision if I have to. Now, I have enough memory cards right now in my little stack that I could probably shoot the AMPAT. And I could, depending on what we run into, I might have enough to cover the entire trip and not erase a card.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% certain of that. But I got 3 8-gig cards now. And then my older 4-gig cards as well. So that's a huge amount just in flash. And I think, you know, I think that's where it's going. I mean, I think when you're doing, you know, unless you're out there for weeks at a time, we're in a situation now where you could easily have everything you need on cards.
Yeah.
And if you didn't bring your laptop, you'd be okay. Other than from a backup standpoint. Mm-hmm. Now, the other alternative is the portable storage device. Mm-hmm. And these, there was a whole bunch of these come out. There's a lot of different varieties, and I know Epson made a pretty big splash a few years mm-hmm. ago with theirs, and
they make very nice ones.
Yeah, and these are really good viewers. They have a mm-hmm. nice high resolution LCD screen on them, and you can review your images on, and that's very good. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where that's going right now because of what we were talking about with the cards becoming cheaper.
Yeah,
because a portable storage device is going to be, you know, several hundred dollars, and that only gets you about, you know, 80 to 100 gigs of space, some of them even less than that. Mm-hmm. They tend to have fairly slow transfer rates. I don't know if the newer ones on the market now take advantage of the faster cards in the same way. And they still require batteries. So, I mean, I know you have one, and mm-hmm. Fill me in on what, I don't remember what kind you have.
It's one that's not made anymore. It's a thing called a Flash Tracks.
Okay.
And it's a pretty nice unit. I think it's a 40 gigabyte one, and it has a pretty decent display. It's not as good as the Epson, but it works fine, you know, in situations where I want to back my cards up to something. And, you know, what I found is I'm, just because of the increasing size of flash cards and the cheaper prices, I'm using it less and less. You know, for example, quite a few podcasts ago, we talked about a trip that I took with my son in January where we went to Eastern Europe, and I took my D200, and, you know, I was shooting in compressed RAW mode, and I think I actually got everything on that trip on a 4-gig card. You know, I had more with me, but that was plenty, and there was no quality issue, you know, going with the compressed RAW. So I didn't even take an external drive of any type. I just took some flashcards, and it was more than adequate. I could have gone several more weeks without any kind of storage. It just depends on what you're doing.
And it also depends on, you know, the importance of backing up your image. Mm-hmm. Had you been on an assignment, mm-hmm. you know, if someone was paying you big bucks to go to Eastern Europe,
then I probably would have done it. But flashcards are, frankly, darned reliable.
Yeah.
So it wasn't something I was worried about.
So that's kind of where we're at with that. And as the price of memory continues to plummet, I think at some point we're going to be in a world where you can just have everything on flashcards.
Mm-hmm. Now, what some people do, and we could do, I don't think either of us does it right now, is we've both got drives inside our laptops that will write to DVDs. So what some people will do is, while they're out there in the field, periodically burn all their images to DVDs too, as just an additional means of storing.
I've never done that in the field simply because I don't want to bring a spindle of DVDs right. with me on a plane.
Right, but some people
do that. You could mm-hmm. do that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Although I feel like storing it on a hard drive or on a flash card is more reliable than a DVD. I've had DVDs go bad.
Yeah.
I think if you're gonna go with DVDs and you're interested in you know, really archiving your images, mm-hmm. then it's probably worth it to look into the gold DVDs. They cost more, but they're supposed to last a heck of a lot longer. Mm-hmm. So just something to do. And hey, with that D3, when you get your D3, you can put two compact flash cards.
Oh, I know.
Use one as the primary and one as the redundant backup. So, yeah. You know, I think pros everywhere, you know, we're really moving towards a compact flash, or at least a flash memory, whether it's whatever form mm-hmm. factor it is, a flash memory kind of world.
That was just one of those little fine points in the D3 design that probably a lot of people didn't notice, but it's quite nice.
Can you imagine?
Very clever.
You could have two 16 gig cards in that thing.
Yeah.
You'd shoot for weeks on it. Okay.
All right. The Firefly.
Yeah. This is something, I was at, PMA mm-hmm. in Las Vegas earlier this year, and I made my rounds, said hi to some people. And I stopped by a little booth for a guy from a company called NRD, making a product called the Firefly, which is kind of this, which was their answer to it's a new sensor cleaning tool. And NRD Industries is a company that's always dealt with, they make ionizers, mm-hmm. amongst other things. And so they had an interesting product. What they've done is they've essentially modified a standard Giotto's rocket blower, and they've modified it to accept an ionizing unit that's battery powered. And so you have this gigantic blower that you can engage in. It what it does is it blows out a stream of ionized air, positive and negative charge, so that it neutralizes any static on the surface on which you're blowing those ionized, you know, on that air. The idea in principle makes a lot of sense. We've talked about sensor cleaning in the past. There's a lot of debate over, you know, how you should best clean your sensor. We've talked about different methods. Clearly, a blower is the least invasive way of cleaning your sensor. Mm-hmm. And it would be the, you know, our first choice of cleaning a sensor is to use some kind of blower. The knock on blowers has been, they can't get rid of some particles. They just move the particles around because your sensor over time, as you use it, builds up a static charge, mm-hmm. which tends to create, allow little dust bits to stick to it. And those might be hard to remove. So here's a solution that purports to solve that problem by blowing ionized air and completely neutralizing the surface of the sensor. Now, of course, I'm pretty skeptical. And so they sent me a unit to test, and they asked if I would look at it. And I have to say, you know, my first thought was, well, how is this going to be, you know, any better than blowing my sensor off with a regular blower? So I talked to the guys at NRD, and they were kind enough to send me some instrumentation. I got to play Dr. Science. It was fun. Ooh. Yeah, I mean, it's good old days of doing science fair experiments. Because I wanted to see if this product would actually work as advertised. Because I'm certainly not going to do controlled testing with, I don't have enough cameras, and I'm not going to put dirt specs on my sensor and try to test it that way. So I had to use something that I could see and be convinced of. So what I did was, they sent me a little handheld electrostatic field meter, which is kind of funky, a little box, and I mm-hmm. played Mr. Spock with my tricorder, and you can point it at things, and it will read.
That's just too easy to visualize, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, my ears aren't that pointed yet. Nevertheless, and I don't have green blood. I'm convinced of that.
Okay.
So I took this thing out, and what I did was, the first thing I did was I took a plastic CD-ROM jewel case, and, you know, I kind of rubbed it on a piece of wool. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, there was a pretty heavy static charge. And when I then applied the Firefly blower to that and remeasured, I noticed that static charge had been almost, but not entirely, eliminated. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, you know, maybe that's just because the charge is really huge. They sent me, the NRD people sent me a small plastic, a piece of Lucite that was approximately the same size and shape as a camera sensor. And with that, I was able to put a static charge on it, but because it's a different kind of material, it wasn't nearly the intensity of the charge that you get with something like a CD jewel case. And then when I used the Firefly, the static charge went pretty much to zero. Mm-hmm. So then I did experiment number two. So the information from the meter was telling me that, yes, this was actually behaving as average. You know, it is getting rid of the static charge. And so just to test again, I did the CD jewel case test again. And I crushed up a little piece of styrofoam packing peanuts. And if anyone who's ever played with those, you know that they hold static charge like
better than almost anything.
Yeah, amazingly well. Yeah. So I crushed a styrofoam peanut and took my statically charged CD-ROM jewel case and, you know, stuck all, and sure enough, you know, these things stuck right well to it. Mm-hmm. I took my rocket blower, my standard rocket blower, and I was able to pretty easily dislodge all the particles, or most of them, mm-hmm. from the CD-ROM jewel case. But sure enough, when I held the CD-ROM jewel case back over the dislodged styrofoam particles, they all just jumped right back and stuck to it. Mm-hmm. So then I repeated the experiment the same way, only this time I used the Firefly with the ionizing airstream. And again, it blew all the particles off of the CD-ROM jewel case. But then when I took the jewel case and held it over the styrofoam peanuts, they didn't stick to it. So that's the interesting thing. Mm-hmm. This unit pretty much is designed to be used with two hands. Therefore, you need to mount your camera onto a tripod and point your camera body down to do this. This is not a one-handed thing. It's a little bit large. I mean, I would say
it's like something you would spray bugs with in the
in the old style, because the unit itself is fairly large. It takes it fits in the palm of your hand, but you hold one hand holds the unit, the other hand you use to operate the blower bulb. And so
it's almost a foot long.
Yeah, it is. It's not compact.
Inches, yeah.
So I've been using it on my camera before shoots, just, you know, as a preventative measure. And all I can say at this point is that I haven't had any problems with dust since I've been using it. Mm-hmm. Now, is this the right product for you? I mean, is everyone going to run out and say this is the solution? Maybe, maybe not. First of all, this blower, as with any blower, isn't going to dislodge. It's not going to get rid of grease or stuck particles. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you've got something that's kind of glued on there, you're going to have to eventually wet clean your sensor.
And I think this depends a little bit on where you live and what the climate is like. Mm-hmm. You know, we've talked a little bit about it before. Honestly, I have very, very few problems with dust.
Right, and you just use a regular blower, right?
Yeah, all I ever do is just every few months give it a little squirt with the Giotto rocket thing, which works great. I've never wet cleaned the sensor on my D2X or my D200. I just never have.
And, but then I've heard people where they run into dust all the time.
Yeah, so it just depends. And you know, one of the things I don't do is regularly take pictures of the wide-angle lens where I point it at the sun, stop it down to f/22, and then examine the images, you know, at high contrast to look for minute particles of dust. I simply take pictures. If I see problems with dust, I give it a squirt. If I don't, I don't worry about it. And I think that's probably a good way to go. You know, don't overreact and try to find things that you're never going to see in real pictures.
Yeah, if they're not in your pictures, then don't worry about it.
And avoid cleaning it if you can in general.
Mm-hmm. You know, obviously this solution is a good one from the standpoint that it's non-contact. You're not, you know, even with a, you know, I have a brush. I have a Copper Hill brush, mm-hmm. But I know a lot of people trust the visible dust brushes. You have to keep them clean, mm-hmm. and a brush is still coming in contact with your sensor. So if you get finger grease, you know, little, you know, skin oil on there, then you've just made a grease spot on your sensor.
Yeah,
I have to say I'm guilty of doing that once or twice. And then you got to go back to your wet cleaning. Mm-hmm. The Firefly is not inexpensive. It lists on their website at www.nrdfirefly.com for $199 US. So this is not cheap, especially when you consider the price of a regular blower. You can have...
Yeah. You ought to have special needs, probably.
Mm-hmm. But I would say if you're a studio, you know, if you're working in environments where dust can be a problem, where you're not having to... you know, where you don't need to pack super light. It's a good unit. It does have an inline filter on the blower, which is important because, you know, if you buy it, I mean, I guess we could say you can get a cheap bulb blower, but you should stay away from like the really cheap ones, because some of those can actually blow more particles onto your sensor, because if the rubber inside the bulb flakes off. Mm-hmm. So this actually has a filter in line. So, I mean, it's a high-end kind of tool for those who really, you know, want to use that. I would say, based on my experience, that it works, but with a price of $199 and a somewhat, a two-handed operation, it's not going to be for someone who's just casually going around. You know, I wouldn't say that this is the must-have in your bag, but I think it's a good product.
Yeah. All right, let's move to something more creative now.
Yes.
Enough technology.
Exactly.
Cropping.
That is, yep, creative cropping.
And this is our prescription for the week. And I think the main point is, do it.
Yeah. Well, let's step back for a second, mm-hmm. and say, you know, what we're talking about here is creative cropping. Everybody knows that sometimes you, for whatever reason, you have to crop an image to make it look better. I mean, okay, I'm going to crop out that funny looking sign in the background or whatever it might be. And you do that. We are both still very much advocates of cropping in the camera.
As much as you can.
But sometimes it is, so there's two times where you need to crop, because one is that, you know, you couldn't get any closer to your subject, so you got a lot of extraneous background you get rid of. Mm-hmm. But then the second thing is, well, if I'm going to crop it, do I want to keep the same aspect ratio? Or do I want to do something more creative with my crop?
Yeah, and from my viewpoint, there's nothing magic about a 2:3 aspect ratio, you know, which is what Nikon film cameras and digital cameras have. There's nothing magic about it. I mean, you know, as we've talked about before, I still like shooting medium format film on occasion, and the camera I use most for that has an aspect ratio that's more like a 4:5. And that works great too. It's a little bit different, and frankly, it's probably a little bit closer to how I end up cropping a lot of my images anyway. But that's a good kind of aspect ratio. Some people love, you know, shooting in a 6:6 format, which is square, and that works really well for them. There is nothing magic about 2:3. So it gets you the point of, why not consider some other things?
Well, and in fact, as we talked about a little bit last week with the 5:4 crop, mm-hmm. in that D3, there's nothing magic about 2:3. And in fact, if you're printing 8x10s or 16x20s, you have to crop.
Right.
You have to change the aspect ratio to a 5:4. Mm-hmm. So there's times where you can do that. But square crops can be interesting. And then the other crop that I've tried doing, I know you have too, is the panoramic crop.
Right.
Now, we've talked about panoramic images where we stitch things together and you have these really long or tall. You know, don't limit yourself to just the horizontal. You can do a panoramic crop in the vertical as well. And I've seen some really cool pictures of tall buildings,
right?
You know, done in a vertical panoramic crop. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't necessarily need a stitch. You can just crop the image so that it's.
The fact is that if you're shooting with a camera that's like a 10 megapixel camera or a 12 megapixel camera, that's so much data that there usually aren't a whole lot of images trimming off the top and the bottom or the sides or whatever. You can still get a great print at a pretty darn large size. Doing it, and it's fun.
Yeah.
And some images just work much better in those kind of crops. So give it a try, and maybe even consider giving yourself an assignment where you deliberately look for images that work best in a square format or, you know, a heavily panoramic one.
Now,
it's a very cheap and easy way to get a different look.
Real fast, how do you do the crop? You'll need to use a tool like Photoshop or Capture NX, both have crop tools.
Yeah, Lightroom, lots of other ones.
Yeah, and check for the options on constraining the aspect ratio on the crop. Usually, by default, the crop tools will be what's called free crop. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can just sort of stretch the square to any shape that you want, well, any aspect ratio that mm-hmm. you want. And that works fine when you're just trying to, you know, use a picture for your website or something. But when you want to actually constrain the aspect ratio to get an exact, you know, a 5:7 or a 1:1, you know, a 6:6 crop or 5:4 crop, then in Photoshop, you can go into the, when you click on the crop tool, there's usually a toolbar that shows up that you can change it to set, you can type in the number mm-hmm. for the width by height dimension. So like if you want a square crop, you could just type 1 and 1. In Photoshop, you can also set, you can use the crop tool to change the resolution of the image, but that's outside the scope of what what we're talking about here with just changing the aspect ratio. And I know in Capture NX, you can do the same thing. You just have to double click on the crop tool icon and it'll give you that option to bring up a fixed aspect ratio, or which is, then you can type in a custom one, but it has some presets like 16 by 20 or 8 by 10. And then you can also use the free crop.
Yeah. And we mentioned Lightroom before. It'll do the same thing.
And there's other ones out there too that'll oftentimes do cropping. Just whether or not it will constrain the aspect ratio. You just have to look into that.
But when you know that's where you're headed because of a certain, print size or whatever, it's a nice, easy way to go because it's simple. It forces you right to that shape.
Right. And then you
often will even interpolate the image up for you to the right size.
And then you won't have problems when you go to resize it later to make sure it's exactly the right size. Cause you want an 8x10, you get an 8x10, not an 8x9.5. So,
but the key thing is think about cropping. It's not just something that you do because you're stuck. It's actually a creative tool and a cheap one.
Yes, it is. Okay. So that's our show for today. If you've got an example of a creative crop, send it to us in a JPEG in an email to talkradio@nikonians.org. No, is it .com?
I can't remember.
.org. No, I know this every week. talkradio@nikonians.org. Yeah, and I'll need some more coffee this morning, I guess.
Yep.
And send us an example of your crop, and maybe we'll talk about it next time or use it on the show notes page.
Yeah, and as always, we appreciate your comments on Podcast Alley, and you can get to that via our
the show notes page.
The show notes page. Yep.
There's a link there, and that show notes page is always found at blog@nikonians.org. Mm-hmm. And if you go there, you can see all of our episodes back to the beginning of time.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us again. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.